The American people have borne massive economic, social, and medical expenditures due to the failed drug war. Doug Fine is here to share some of those equally surprising and ridiculous details regarding marijuana prohibition that he's written about in his book, Too High to Fail. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Doug, I get the subtitle of your book, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution, but why title it Too High to Fail?
Amazingly, that is the first time I've been asked that question. Basically, it's a play on the too big to fail financial crisis concept, whereas that's often used in a negative connotation. I meant the title in a positive way. Basically, this cannabis plant is our nation's number one cash crop already, with none of it, almost none of it, playing into the legitimate economy, rather favoring cartels and underground economies. And the industrial side can help us wean from foreign oil. So it's basically advocating an end to the drug war.
Right. You moved to Mendocino area of California to zero in on cannabis. Tell us your motive and why Mendocino.
Because the 40-year trillion-dollar cost of taxpayer drug war was obviously not working, I wanted to see a place that was experimenting with a drug peace rather than a drug war, a place where it was done. And Mendocino County had acknowledged that 80%+ of its economy came from cannabis cultivation, and why not permit it and derive some revenue from it instead of pretending that it doesn't exist? You have $6 billion in revenue in the county alone coming from cannabis. The number one currently legal plant there, or previously legal plant, was grapes at $74 million. So if you're a young 4-H farmer in Northern California, which crop are you going to choose? And so the Board of Supervisors up there endorsed a plan by the sheriff to zip tie with a little yellow bracelet, 99 plants per farm maximum with a bunch of environmental and other zoning regulations, for an $8,500 overall fee that includes third-party inspections per year for a crop that could be worth as much as $1 million. Worked for everyone until the feds came in and shut it down.
When did they shut it down, and how long actually did it go on before they did shut it down?
The year that I followed a plant that we named Lucille, it was a farmer named it after, the farmer that I followed, Thomas, named it after an initially belligerent neighbor of his who came to sort of understand him and support him, was 2011. I started with the cloning of his outdoor-grown cannabis plants and followed all the way to a liver cancer battler who needed the flowers for appetite stimulation. So a 10-month period that I followed it. Over the course of that year, the program was so successful, the zip-tie program in Mendocino County was so successful, it generated with 100 farmers deciding they wanted to come above board and be open, tax-paying members of society like everyone else. 100 farmers generated $600,000+ for the county, saving 7 deputy sheriff jobs that had been slated for budget cuts in a financially struggling county like so many are right now. It was so successful that Sheriff Tom Allman, the popular twice-elected sheriff in Mendocino County, was touring neighboring counties, including Humboldt County and others in the Emerald Triangle up there, that were strongly considering implementing a program. And then days before harvest, the DEA came and raided the sort of poster child for the zip-tie program, a farmer I knew well named Matt Cohen. Chopped down all his plants, came in with the machine guns, kept him and his wife separated in handcuffs for 9 hours, no access to attorneys, bankrupted his cooperative, kept many people, including many cancer patients and elderly people, from getting their medicine that they relied on, domestic, tax-paying, locally permitted cannabis. So basically, as the California director of Normal put it, a victory for the cartels, taxpayer-funded, put him out of business, and then some weeks later, the U.S. Attorney for Northern California personally threatened the members of the Board of Supervisors in Mendocino County with federal prosecution for conspiracy if they didn't cancel this successful program, and so they did.
Now, was this just a one-year program? Is that what it was? It was legalized for 1 year, the zip tie program, and then it was literally chopped down there?
Or... No, it was a little bit longer than that. They'd been toying with it for a while. Mendocino County is quite a remarkable place. In 2000, Mendocino County first legalized cannabis for all uses. I believe it was up to 25 plants. You might argue somewhat symbolic, but not really, because the county, you know, sheriffs, deputies, those people weren't going after people for 25 or fewer plants in most cases. Starting in 2000, that was modified a few times. They started a zip tie program in fits and starts a few times. The new program that I covered really got going in 2010, but it took a while. You can imagine, in an underground economy, it took a while for word to get around, and it quintupled in popularity and was in the year I followed, 2011, and was poised to really take off around Northern California and presumably, hopefully, around the country, and that's when it was shut down. So no, it wasn't intended to just be a short-term program, but that's what, for now, hopefully, not for much longer, the federal government mandated.
Right. I just feel so sorry for that farmer who lost all of his profit.
And the hundreds of thousands of Americans who are currently in jail for nonviolent so-called drug offenses.
Right, yes. Well, California's largest medical group, the California Medical Association, has called for legalization, and mental health centers like the Seven Counties Services in Tennessee, who are refusing drugs like Xanax to their 30,000-plus patients due to side effects and abuse, are doing what they do, and yet this legislation does stand. And I'm wondering, do you think that states, where are we as far as the states getting away from their national big brother in being able to come down like this?
Well, first, you raise a good point in bringing up pharmaceuticals, because that's America's real epidemic, that and alcohol. So to erase the stigma associated particularly with cannabis, I think we're almost there as a nation. The nationwide polls have 80 to 90% of Americans in all demographics. I live in the heartland, and everybody knows. My old lady neighbors in cowboy hats know that the drug war is wrong. It doesn't work, and it shouldn't be being fought. And we need to be deriving revenue from the great plant of cannabis and not prosecuting it. But and not just psychoactive, spiritual, social, medical cannabis, but industrial cannabis in particular as well. So there's precedent for this ending in alcohol prohibition. There's a lot of similarities. First of all, towards the end of prohibition, prosecution got stepped up in ways that regular Americans that might not have really cared about the issue found very objectionable and contrary to American values. Speakeasies being raided, people just wanted to have a beer, and getting hauled, you know, legitimate, respectable people getting hauled off to jail. And as we've discussed already, that's now starting to happen. When Americans hear about a raid of a tax-paying, locally permitted farmer, and that's where their federal tax dollars are going, they're outraged. They're outraged, and it's firing people up. We're seeing 56% now of America's nationwide polls, very mainstream polls, saying it's time to regulate cannabis like alcohol and get cannabis the heck out of the Controlled Substances Act and just stop the nonsense overall. So we could be close, but it's going to really take people making it their issue. Mainstream people who don't necessarily care about cannabis one way or another saying, you know, we need to get this in the economy and spend our federal dollars better than we have been in this drug war.
Sure. Do you put hemp and cannabis in the same category regarding its Schedule I listing? And do you see a separation, at least in the category, happening soon? I mean, obviously, most of us know by this point in time that hemp really is a different plant than what people grow the cannabis sativa or, the other...
Indica or whatever.
Yeah, indica, yes.
I really see it all as one. I mean, I don't think that cannabis should even be listed under the Controlled Substances Act at all, and here's why. It's currently absurdly listed as a Schedule I narcotic.
Right, and isn't hemp as well?
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in fact, I had an interesting experience in Colorado one time. I was going on the speaker shuttle to go give a talk at a sustainability festival in Fort Collins, and there was a really knowledgeable USDA biologist on biofuels telling me all about all kinds of great biofuels and ones that I hadn't heard of before, Hatropha and grapeseed and switchgrass and all this terrific stuff. And I just started research on what was going to become this book, Too High to Fail, and I said, so what about cannabis? And she said, oh, yeah, magnitude's better than any of these other things, but it's a Schedule I felony, so we can't research it on the federal level. So, it all needs to get out of the Controlled Substances Act. The reason why I say get out of it entirely is, A, that lets states regulate like alcohol. B, it allows industrial cannabis to be grown, as you pointed out, non-psychoactive. But also, it prevents what I and a lot of people are concerned about, which is a sort of sneaky perceived compromise where cannabis is, let's say, moved into Schedule 2 or 3, and then a pharmaceutical company or two is granted some sort of patent to isolate a few concentrates or cannabinoids, when in reality this is a plant that humans have been co-evolving with for millennia, and the entire plant needs to be available for use, and so to have in a non-patentable way, and so that's why I don't want to play around with this whole reclassification. I just want it out of the Controlled Substances Act altogether.
Right. Well, I think that's further down the line than lowering its category, I would imagine. I wanted to ask you, now that you bring it up, obviously we all know, too, that pharmaceutical companies are always trying to single out that one potent ingredient from a plant, and mostly they are unsuccessful at it. And I'm wondering, is it purely the THC numbers that create medicinal efficacy, or are there other properties worth mentioning in the plant cannabis?
That is a great question. So the short answer is many, many more. At the moment, more than 90 known. Research has been hampered for so long that the Schedule I classification, which, by the way, considers cannabis, despite what the California Medical Association, despite what the American Medical Association says, despite the oldest existing medical handbook, which is 3,000 years old from China, despite what it says, it classifies it as having no medical properties at all, and even cocaine and meth are in Schedule 2. That's no accident. It hampers research. Researchers can't get their hands on it, or for a long time have had trouble getting their hands on cannabis to do their research. And so research has been hampered. But even with that, the initial cannabinoid, the component of cannabis that was isolated in 1964 in Israel, THC, more than 90 known, and quite a number of them are already showing very promising medical properties. The one that is getting a lot of attention of late is CBD. It's a non-psychoactive cannabinoid that has been showing some promise in tumor reduction as well as pain reduction. And, the danger of isolating one cannabinoid and putting it in a pill is that we don't know whether or not it's the interplay of different cannabinoids in different ratios that provides the efficacy in different areas.
Yes. Let's talk about the oil then, because I know that that is one product that's being made from cannabis that seems to be having quite great success with cancers and tumor reductions. And have you come across people making the oil? And is it obviously, if it was legalized, the reliability of a product could be better monitored. But are you coming across people using the oil and or maybe more importantly, producing the oil?
I have met some people. I think it's called Simpson's oil. The particular what we're talking about here is a concentrate of medical cannabis oil. This is distinguished from the also very healthy and legal to use, but not legal to grow, hemp oil, which is something I put in my family's morning shake every day. You can buy it at the supermarket.
Right. That's a different thing.
Yeah. Which, by the way, the great omega balance to perfect nutritional oil if you want to get your healthy fatty acids without risking mercury from fish oil or whatever.
Well, I would argue that point, but we'll do that another time.
Okay. Oh, really? Okay. All right, but I'm interested in that. But so on the issue, though, of concentrates and edible concentrates as medicinal, I am aware of people that do that, and I think it's terrific, especially for people that might be at a stage of life where smoking isn't really viable for them, at least not regular smoking or regular vaporizing. So, I do think that that's a great idea, and I agree with you that efficacy and uniformity is something that we'll see more of. Incidentally, in that program in Mendocino County, the ZipTie program, the farmers are really in favor of all those kind of tests that you're talking about to make sure that there's, for instance, no molds, no pesticides in the flowers that go to patients, but also which cannabinoids in which percentages are in that. And you're starting to see that testing being made available to patients. I'm sure that's true in Colorado as well.
I wonder if there's a point where farmers growing the cannabis and getting the strains of THC to strengthen, do you think there's a point where that plant would need to be crossed over and considered a drug?
Well, you know, we've been co-evolving with this plant for so long. I have faith in what Michael Pollan talks about as the botany of desire in his first book, that our bodies and the plants kind of know what to do. I don't want to venture too far to woo-woo. I come from kind of an East Coast medical family, and I consider myself sort of middle of the road on this kind of thing. I sound super crunchy to my family and a little bit sort of mainstream maybe to some of my friends, and I think that's good. But I'm not really worried. You know, the issue of why THC percentages have gone up so much, let's say, in the last 20 or 30 years in cannabis is very easy to understand. It's prohibition. People want the most bang for their buck in a small package that's easy to transport when they're creating a huge risk by transporting it or using it or buying it or whatever it is, or growing it. And so I think we'll see a little bit of a reversal there, but I don't think that any of the cannabinoids are the bad guy. I don't think there's a problem, but I do think we may see people that are seeking, let's say, a more balanced cannabinoid profile in their cannabis for whatever reasons that they enjoy and employ cannabis. In other words, they might not want a 22% THC content. They might want a 13% THC content and a 12% CBD content, and who knows how many. It'll be like a multivitamin, how many cannabinoids people will be educated about in 5 years.
Yes, good point. You are so well-versed, Doug, in a lot of the basic numbers of keeping this product underground. I mean, there's tax revenue that's lost. There are tax dollars spent on the drug war that only seem to remove 1% from the underground marketplace. The banks, billions of dollars of laundering money that goes on. What was most striking to you in researching and finding out these amazing numbers?
You know, I think what's most striking is that the numbers are right out there for everybody to know. Pat Robertson, the televangelist, knows it. Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State, George Shultz, knows it. Why does Congress not know it? That's the only thing that shocks me. We know it's the number one cash crop. We know the cartels make 70% of their profits from it. We know that Americans want it. We know that humans have used it for thousands of years. Why isn't it in our economy? That's what's astounding.
So is it the cartels that are so strong that are actually running things, pulling strings behind the scenes? What do you garnish from all of this? What do you find with all of this?
I only have a guess because I think there's a lot of complex interplay going on. But what I think there's a couple of factors. One is any bureaucracy that exists, and the drug war bureaucracy, let's say, has existed for 40 years. It's actually existed since 1937 in the case of cannabis, when prohibition ended, and that bureaucracy switched over to fight this demon weed that was, I think Harry Anslinger said, it's only Negro jazz singers using it to corrupt white women or whatever.
That it was the exact year that DuPont created plastic.
Right, and you know, I've heard different arguments about whether the demonization was a conspiracy as a result of that, or just Hearst's newspapers finding it convenient, you know, to paint these sort of racist or outlandish stories demonizing this plant. But to a degree, I think bureaucratic inertia is one of the factors. It's just hard when you've got $30 billion a year being spent to just say, no, let's go. It's like when an army base is no longer needed in a particular area because there's a newer, more updated one 40 miles away, but it's in someone else's congressional district, the first congressperson is going to say, oh, no, we do have too many jobs that are dependent on it. And we look at that person and go, are you really saying that, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Fiscal Conservative? You're saying let's spend $200 million on your district for an admittedly unnecessary base, an obsolete base, just because it has some jobs? So to a degree, that's what's happening with the drug war money. And then what's also happening is I don't think that a lot of heartland politicians yet understand that they're – that it's a safe issue, that constituents from Kansas to, you know, Hawaii don't want the drug war anymore. It would be actually a popular decision to support legalizing cannabis.
Right. You spoke earlier about even your cowboy hat wearing neighbor, older woman knows that cannabis is not necessarily the evil that it's been purported to be. And it's funny because I think if you take all the farmers that grow tobacco in the Southeast and all of the farmers, they're the ones that do know. They're the ones that are growing it illegally. They are the ones that realize their land can be so much more profitable if they could do something like this. And it is those people in the middle, for once. The middle people that aren't quite aware of it. And maybe that's the middle class for the most part. I don't know. But it's an interesting group that are still sort of on the outside of what's really going on.
You know, North Dakota's agricultural commissioner said in 2007, we need to get on this industrial cannabis thing. It's
right.
Huge. Why are we not doing this?
Across the border in Canada, it's happening.
Growing 20% a year in Canada.
Yeah. That's amazing. It's also kind of a joke to consider going to a doctor, speaking about how things need time to change for a cannabis prescription. First of all, research is in baby steps and stages because of its Schedule I listing. But also, there's not quite a semester of pot prescribing in medical school going on. So the fact that it's even going to be this medical item is a joke, really.
Well, for one thing, just if you talk about social, spiritual, general use, keeping outside of medicinal, or you might call it health maintenance, whatever, however you want to classify psychoactive use for not explicit acute medical treatment, almost every study indicates that all the drug war propaganda we were fed is untrue. For one thing, it is, in almost all areas, considerably less dangerous than alcohol. We don't know a lot about effects on throat and esophagus, but we do know a lot of studies are saying not damaging to lungs. And that's just smoked, of course. There's also edible versions. Then there's, is it a gateway drug? Study after study, no. Are there long-term negative cognitive effects? One study I read out of Australia said not even in regular long-term smokers. In other words, if there is any cognitive impairment, it's not long-term and it's not permanent, especially if a user were to cut back. So it's a plant that we've co-evolved with for millennia. And so it's, you know, there's not a lot of downsides. It's not a very dangerous plant for responsible use among adults. Obviously, issues, when the, what I call the drug piece comes, issues have to be dealt with, like driving and how to test for that, because it's not as easy to test. Blood alcohol, let's say, is obvious, but for THC, you can't necessarily go by that type of test, and you need more of a standard impairment test just to see whether someone's capable to drive, not what's necessarily in their bloodstream. But strictly on the medicinal end, although it's not currently taught in medical schools, it is in the oldest existing medical handbook from China 3,000 years ago, as I mentioned. And so it does. There's no question. I've spoken to dozens of people, including seniors in conservative Orange County, California, that credit it with saving their lives. So there, you know, I don't want to totally discount the medical properties.
Right. In your book, Too High to Fail, you compare growing cotton and growing hemp, saying so many pesticides are used to grow cotton and hemp would grow without so much of their use. But I just wanted to bring up a point that it's kind of naive to think like that, because I think when you get into production scale growing, whether it's hemp or cotton, I think similar needs would start to pop up, don't you think?
That's a good point. In other words, when something gets commoditized, industrial factors can come into play. I think you're probably right about that, and I'm not necessarily an agricultural expert on that level, but the U.S. Agricultural National Report for 1895, so, you know, a little over 100 years ago, talked about how relatively good for the soil the plant is. It has tap roots that are good for soil aeration. It simply is nicer to soil than cotton.
Do you medicate your children with cannabis remedies?
No, unfortunately, I have very, very healthy children, thank God, and I'm not a person who even likes to speculate, but I would say more generally that if somebody came to me and said, doctors don't know what to do, and we don't know what to do, what do you think about this? I would say talk to a doctor who's an expert in the field, and they certainly might recommend this plant.
Doug, you've written this fine book, Too High to Fail, with a lot of compelling reasons to get this new green economic revolution rolling. What do you want to see happen?
Even with all the big issues in the world, currency crises and teetering dictatorship and hunger and drought, climate change, I think that tied into many of them, I'd like to see Americans with a unified voice say the drug war needs to end, specifically cannabis needs to get out of the Controlled Substances Act for the good of America.
Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail, will be at the Boulder Bookstore on August 15th. For any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.